the people who proposed it didn't want to do it. There was no support, and it collapsed. The vote was overwhelmingly against it. But it is a pity, because it might have been possible to introduce a counterpart to integrated liberal studies, an integrated curriculum, which would be non-Western. And indeed, a group of six of us did develop exactly such a curriculum. A ringleader in that was Phil Curtin. Phil Curtin, Joe Elder, and a person I will deal with a little bit later, Dick Robinson, and a couple of other people, perhaps, well, I don't know, perhaps an anthropologist was in on this. We worked up such a program, but it got caught in the faculty backlash against the non-Western ILS, and so it lost its political viability.
The non-Western ILS?
Yeah, this program that was commissioned by Elvehjem to...
Oh, I see.
...to be done for scientists.
Yeah.
It got caught in recoiling against that on the part of many, many faculty people.
That's just extraordinary that Elvehjem should have thought of that. Do you think he felt the scientists could never catch up to the humanists in their own field, like the Greek classics and history, and therefore was giving them a territory that they could...
No, I don't think that. I don't know what his reason was, but all kinds of things might be possible. Remember when Oppenheimer saw the first atomic explosion, he quoted from Bhagavad Gita.
Did he?
And yes.
A marvelous series.
The light of a thousand suns.
Are you watching
suns?
It? The no. Oppenheimer series now?
I haven't caught this
latest. Oh, it's
latest
fascinating.
One.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are a number of themes in classic Indian scriptures that have tremendous modern relevance, and if a person is standing apart from our direct heritage of religion and values, let's take on the environmental side, you know, the Judeo-Christian approach to the environment is...
Use it up.
Well, I have, God says, I make man dominion over the creatures of the earth and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indian concept that we have not only an equal position on the earth, but that our lives, our endless rebirths intertwine with those of all animals on the earth, that is in some ways a much more congenial sort of basic approach. So there may be many reasons why Elvehjem would be attracted to that, and one reason might be Harrington. He might have picked up enough of this enthusiasm from Harrington to think of orienting this program in that direction.
Oh, that's Harrington.
Yes, it would be very valuable
that's
to find
really
out. Well, to get back to the chronology, sometime at the end of January in 1960, one of these people whom I had invited to take an appointment that wasn't yet funded was an anthropologist named William McCormick, which is spelled M-A-C-K. And McCormick was spending a research year in London, and he cabled me saying, I have an offer, I think it was from the University of Minnesota, which is funded. Do you have any money to pay the salary that you have talked about to me?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any money because the HEW people had not responded. So I telephoned the administrative man with whom I had dealt, and he said, the department has decided to give you the center, But it has to be announced by your congressman, Congressman Kastenmeyer. So in due course, you will hear from him, but you can commit the funds anyway.
Kastenmeyer, that yes. long ago?
I think so. I think so.
Yeah.
So it might have been Glenn Davis. Kastenmeyer succeeded Davis, but yeah, it might well have been. It might well have been Glenn Davis, or it might have been one of our senators. But in any event, then we did make these appointments, and McCormick was one of them. And another one, whose very nature was absolutely crucial to the lines of development of our program, was a unique intellectual named Richard Robinson. Robinson was born in a economically hard struggling Canadian family in Calgary. And he comes as close to being a sheer intellectual genius as I have ever encountered. One sign of that was that whereas the brightest people at his age, which was, I suppose, then about 30, would have been able to master classical Chinese enough to deal with religious topics through Chinese. Robinson had done that, but in addition had mastered Sanskrit enough to deal with religion through Sanskrit.
'70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess about 1970. Let me explain about Robinson, that he was identified by Murray Fowler, probably because Murray Fowler knew him as a high-quality Sanskritist, and also it was very attractive to Murray, as it was to me, though I was much less informed about such things, that here was a man who would offer instruction in Buddhism. We felt that Buddhism was a creation of classical Indian culture that was tremendously understudied. It was certainly not studied much in India, where it had been superseded almost completely by Hinduism. And it was not studied as much as it merited by those who studied East Asia, China and Japan, because it was no longer official religion in either place. So that was a sort of extra dividend presented by this brilliant young Canadian scholar. He had got his PhD at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And Murray told us when we sat around discussing this man that he plays the bagpipes, he said, on New Year's Eve. he goes around town playing the bagpipes. So he came on as an extremely attractive, original, eccentric sort of person, and all those characteristics were fully manifested by what he did here. He had not been here more than one semester when he decided that the University of Wisconsin ought to offer a PhD in Buddhist studies. That was an extraordinarily bold venture, and it would have to be done, aside from Dick Robinson himself, it would have to be done by people doubling in brass, by people being justified for other purposes but having this extra competence to deal with Buddhism. But he succeeded by arguments that only I think he could put forward to convince the graduate school that the university ought to offer such a PhD, and that it was possible with the very slight faculty components that we had to adequately teach it. And I think from that time, Robinson began to supersede Murray Fowler in the humanities side of the leadership of our program here. I would never dream of making an argument with regard to language, religion, linguistics, or any other humanities subject with Murray, because I simply didn't know enough, and because I credited him with steering the program and developing the program in those dimensions up to the 1960s. But Robinson really took delight in taking on Murray on any of those topics. So he had several arguments with regard to the direction in which the program should develop. And he tended to carry the day in those arguments. And I think Murray got the feeling that he was being passed over in determining the strategy of the program that he had through the Rockefeller grant and through creating the department really pioneered.
Besides having brought Robinson here.
Sure, besides having brought Robinson here. So, in any event.
Do you think that's a cause of his bitterness, if there is such?
Well, I think. I don't think bitterness would be proper. I just think that his enthusiasm dried up, so he just turned away. He turned his attention elsewhere. Now, in 1950, then, we had the first year of...
Excuse me.
Sure.
Just, this was within the Department of Indian Studies that this
yes.
is going on.
Sure.
It doesn't involve other faculty
no.
or other
no.
departments.
No. In 1960, I said 50, but I really mean 60, we had the first year of the federally aided center, and I was the director of that, and we had space for that in temporary quarters up on State Street, on the second floor of what used to be called the Chocolate Shop, halfway up to the state capitol on State Street. There was also the academic department, and in between Murray Fowler and Dick Robinson, the chairman of that academic department was Gerald Kelly, who was still an assistant professor. And I think that was probably a strategic mistake for what it did to Kelly. He did all right as chairman, but I think being chairman of that department took so much time and attention away from his research that when the time came for the tenure decision, he was ill-equipped to make out a tenurable sort of record. In any event, he got a very attractive job at Cornell, so he left the University of Wisconsin. Mm. Few years after, well, perhaps 4 or 5 years after he was appointed here in the fall of 1960. By that time, I believe Richard Robinson was ready to, I think he was tenured and he was ready to be chairman of the Department of Indian Studies.
Why weren't these two put together?
Well, fiscally they are separate to this day, and in some institutions the idea of having a separate individual head the academic entity and the center is still pursued. But as soon as Dick Robinson took over, he was at once the center director and the department chairman, and that convention is held right down today. So today the chairman of South Asian Studies is V. Narayan Rao, and the center director is the same individual.
But why aren't these two put together? I mean, you say fiscally they're separate. Why shouldn't they be the same? Why shouldn't the program have come under the department?
Notice that our university, you see, our standard academic department of Indian Studies is a somewhat unique arrangement. Pennsylvania didn't have any academic department. They had a PhD program and a research center, but and the same with Berkeley. So the idea of having a standard academic department was rather unusual, and also even at Wisconsin, the idea of having an academic department in a non-Western culture, which is really interdisciplinary, that is also unique. We have a Department of East Asian Language and Literature, but it is only language and literature. It doesn't contain people who teach East Asian history, don't have joint appointments.
Yeah.
So the roundedness of the department provided much less reason to have a separate center director here. And it was only because we were still unsure about the solidity of the federal program, and because the federal people wanted a center director that they could deal with, who would write their reports and submit the budget in their form and so forth, and they were prepared to pay a little bit towards the salary of that person. So
the people who were hired by the center then weren't on tenure and weren't on tenure track, is that
it? We hired nobody on center only except for a secretary. The director of the center got a small amount of his salary, perhaps 25%, paid by the center budget. And we had a secretary full-time on the center budget. But there was no faculty person whose appointment home was the center. Everybody was a tenure track person, either fully in the department or shared between the department and some social studies department like history or sociology or anthropology or political science. So the center was not a faculty unit, it was a budget unit, and it was an extracurricular program unit, like lectures and conferences and the like.
So not a research program either?
It paid for research. For example, most of our language teaching materials were developed by people holding appointments, often summer appointments, in the center. But the funding for that had to be got ad hoc for that project by another grant from Washington. Research could not be paid for out of the center budget. The center budget tended to pay half of the salaries of the language teaching people and a portion of the administrative overhead. But the center budget was justified in terms of courses. So the United States government bought language courses and area courses, and their guidelines were university could not have been teaching the subject before it began its center contract. and it would not be teaching the subject except for the federal subsidy. So, for example, we couldn't get center money for our Civilization of India course because we had unfortunately started it. Too soon. We were premature.
A little bit like the Poverty Institute.
Yes, except that's holy research and this is holy. The center is holy teaching.
Yeah. Well.
So, the program, I think, became really solid at Wisconsin when we got a sufficiently large tenured staff, which I would say is around about 5 tenured people, so that the executive committee of that academic department could make fair and well-justified decisions, for example, on tenuring people or not tenuring people, and on the allocation of merit increases, and on whether to approve somebody's course proposal or to turn down somebody's course proposal. And I think that stage was reached around about 1965, 66, 67, along in that time. I believe it's fair to say that from that time forward, the dean of the college tended to think of that department as a small department, a department weak in enrollment terms, but of a perfectly competitive intellectual quality, and run in a smooth way, not presenting him with problems that escaped from the proper attention of that faculty. So here again, I think Murray Fowler's idea of creating an academic department has proved to be a very essential element in this story. Well, let me just wind up this coverage of South Asian studies here by giving my impression of where we stand at the moment. We have now gone through 2 very vicious periods of federal cutbacks, vicious in the sense that institutes around the country dealing with South Asia, which had been doing a good job and which had tenured people, have simply been cut off the federal support. And we may be, of course, heading into another such period of vicious competition. University of Wisconsin has not only survived both of those periods of cutting, but has become the, in a sense, one of the chosen vehicles for a much more selective kind of federal development. I think that's true probably for 2 reasons. One is, I believe that our actual training programs, our degree programs and so forth, have been well conceived and have turned out people who found extremely rewarding and prestigious jobs. And that again goes back to the fact that especially through the pioneering of Robinson, the doctoral training was directed at true gaps in American scholarship and in American university staffing. So these people who took PhDs in Buddhist studies And there have been a very large number. I think there have been over 30 PhDs in Buddhist studies alone. They found jobs at first rank universities. One of the first PhDs got an appointment at the University of California, Berkeley, and others have got similarly attractive appointments. And in other ways too, I think the formal degree training has been clearly conceived and has done what it set out to do. So I think that satisfied the federal people. Another thing, however, which I think is very characteristic of Wisconsin is that our program developed a stronger and more effective outreach program throughout the whole state than would be possible for a private university or a university which does not hold such a towering position in the intellectual life of its state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about the possible competitors to the University of Wisconsin in making some sort of knowledge of South Asia available in Wisconsin, there's just nobody within sight of this campus in order to do that. And that strategic factor, I think, has been fully exploited by the chairmen who have developed this program. The chairman who has been longest in office, and of course combining department chairmanship with center director, is a person of Indian birth and upbringing, Manendra Verma, trained as a linguist at the University of Michigan. And he has proved to be a gifted academic administrator, but also a very, very good at developing outreach programs. And one thing that he did that is very visible to the federal decision makers is to develop an annual conference on South Asia that meets in November at Madison. And it's really become a national conference. 300 people attend. They come from all over the country. And most of them find that there is a greater opportunity there for intellectual interchange on India, Pakistan, Ceylon, Bangladesh, Nepal, than there is at the Association for Asian Studies, which is bigger, and but also much more fractioned.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the kind of tangible sign of both intellectual acuity and also of making things available to the public that I think must be attractive to people who spend tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
We have also been quite versatile in the kinds of things that we do. For example, we are the only institution in the 50s and 60s and through most of the 70s that thought it possible to do anything in India with undergraduates.
Oh, yes, I read about that.
I remember very well that I went to the Carnegie Corporation, specifically to an officer of the Carnegie Corporation named Marvell, and proposed that as a pilot sort of experimental project that they authorize the sending of one or two students to India as undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generally conceived to be an impossible thing because Indian college instruction is so poor and and so repulsive to any red-blooded American undergraduate that nobody thought it was worth doing. But we simply worked out a solution to that problem that has proved quite viable, and that is that the student spend a year here in the language and be ready when he got to India to get off campus for as much as possible of his learning. And the core of his experience would be an individual field project that he would do while he was there under the supervision of some Indian faculty member. Counting as 6 credits of academic work, and he could pursue a second year of the language and some highly selected good course to round out his program. But in any event, that program has proved completely workable. It is now being run by Joe Elder, who is superbly suited to deal with undergraduates and to deal with the Indian host institutions. Mm-hmm. So I think has proved completely workable. It is now being run by Joe Elder, who is superbly suited to deal with undergraduates and to deal with the Indian host institutions. Mm-hmm. So I think the people who come through that have a marvelous educational experience. It now tends to run 25, 30 students a year. Now the incidental effect of that is that we have then this many undergraduates who have already had 2 years in an Indian language and who are candidates for graduate work without having to start their language from scratch as graduate students when their time is so preoccupied, should be so preoccupied with their discipline subjects. And that sort of roundedness of program through willingness to innovate and to define problems that are created by the encounter of America with India, I think has been a secret or unnoticed sense of strength for our program. And another thing that I observe is that we, in terms of faculty participation, we're somewhere in between Berkeley and Pennsylvania. Berkeley is an even more departmentally run university than Wisconsin. And there has never been the sense of the large number of faculty people pooling their efforts to try to achieve a single set of objectives in the Berkeley program. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania has a tradition of one-man leadership. Originally it was Norman Brown, then later on it was Richard Lambert. And that also has not evoked from the faculty people such institutional creativity, in my judgment. But also I can't overlook the importance of the University of Wisconsin organizing itself through academic departments, and this program being organized also through an academic department. I think that has been a running theme through the stability or the durability of this program. I think it stands up extremely well in terms of national stature. This kind of thing is hard to be objective about, but I believe the total intellectual productivity of our faculty and the number and quality of the graduate students produced now stand probably as good as any in the country. Probably one would have to draw a specific profile of strengths and weaknesses in order to compare this program with Chicago, Pennsylvania, and Berkeley, and there would be some strengths here and some strengths there. But I certainly don't think there would be any general advantage in stature of any one of those three strong institutions over Wisconsin.
I wonder why there haven't been departments of Latin American studies and Chinese studies, because there aren't they? They're all in terms of programs.
I think it's because in the case of Latin America, there was the Department of Spanish already established. And
yes, I suppose so.
Norman Sachs was a key man in getting the language and area approach accepted as applicable to Spanish, because remember the rationale was we've got desperate manpower shortages that we need to make good by federal subsidies, and you couldn't say that of Spanish. There were Spanish departments turning out PhDs all over the country, and Norman Sachs had the ingenious answer that, but that isn't really Latin American Spanish. So it was called the Ibero-American language.
But that's a program.
Sure.
It's not a department.
That's
I was saying why there weren't. Okay, yes, there's a Spanish department. And China wasn't on the scene for such a long time.
Right. But, and the same with Portuguese. Portuguese was being taught in the East, but the idea of a Luso-Brazilian program, that was something that would appeal to this rationale of we have manpower scarcities that the federal appropriations have to make good.
In the African studies, there was much opposition to forming the African Studies Department, but it did form them.
Right.
How much did the program of international studies have to do with your success, and how did they help you out?
In two ways. That was, of course, very much a project of Fred Harrington, and he put his own man in as the first dean of international studies and programs. I think Henry Hill of History was the first dean. But it helped out in two ways. One was it was a source of money, because the Ford Foundation was giving massive institutional grants of $1 million, $2 million to strong universities as general support for international studies and programs, and that organization permitted Wisconsin to get, I think, $1.5 million under that, or maybe it was more. But in any event, I remember very well being in Harrington's office when he was trying to get a renewal of that grant. And he talked to McGeorge Bundy, the president of the Ford Foundation, and said, in effect, in your renewals, you're manifestly singling out private institutions. And what's the rationale of neglecting the great public universities, except Berkeley? I think Berkeley was a token public university in one of those big grants. Because we have the capability of reaching the people in the state in a way that the private universities don't, and eventually the political limit on what the United States can do overseas will be the acceptance of the general public, and so forth. And I think he bludgeoned Bundy into including the university $1 million or so of renewal grant.
I wonder why they wouldn't have renewed it when you come to think of it, given the strong program here.
Well, I think there was a sort of private school parochialism there in the philanthropic foundations. They regarded the public institutions as having another pocket from which to draw funds that was perhaps larger than the
They figured they'd done it once pocket. And then somebody else could take over.
Sure. The other advantage was the organizational administrative one when the thing came to the operational stage. For example, the formal organization of this undergraduate program is now in the Dean of International Studies and Programs office, although Joe Elder runs it. But he needs an organizational home for it other than the sociology department. That dean is such an organizational home.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, a program like MUSEA, the Midwestern University's Consortium for International Activities, I think that's what the acronym stands for. That's been a very convenient thing for many of our people to get research started in India. That's pretty much the story I would like to leave on record so far as
That's interesting.
South Asia is concerned.
What you have to say about Robinson as being the outstanding intellect that you have
yes.
met? Did he have any impact in the university outside of... And was he so isolated because he was teaching Buddhist studies that he didn't come in contact with other people?
No, not at all. He was a vigorous participant in the linguistics department. Hmm. And when he went to argue a case before the Humanities Divisional Committee, the Executive Committee of the Humanities Division, he served to There were other empire builders in our faculty. You know one of them, Phil Curtin, for example.
Yes.
And Curtin, I think, would very happily have extended programs that he would control. Maybe they would be academically history, but anyway, Curtin would control them to do some of the tasks that Robinson was trying to develop in South Asian studies.
Hmm.
But Robinson was perfectly prepared to meet Phil Curtin on his own ground. I remember once he said, I understand what you're teaching, Phil. You're really teaching the contraction of European expansion. So he was ready with polemic phrases
nice
like that to do battle with anybody.
Nobody in the history department thought of that. Would have loved to have said it, I'm
right.
sure. Well, is Robinson at all responsible for the weakness of the linguistics department?
No. I think, in the first place, academic departments tend to have ups and downs, and there was this period of remarkable eminence of our linguistics department when Einar Haugen was here and that fellow who, I've forgotten his name, who dealt with the German language.
Yes,
those people, they were giants. And I think the linguistics department was right at the top nationally in those times. But I think linguistics departments have more difficulty even than other departments do in maintaining unity, because their profession is one of examining the means of discourse that they should be able to use to argue about their differences. And when you're continually applying the microscope to your means of interpersonal relationships, it's hard it's a little harder than usual to settle your disputes. I remember that at one point I was drawn on to the Rockefeller Foundation's committee to plan and assist in the development of descriptive linguistics in India, because they wanted a person entirely outside of linguistics to work on that. And so I used to meet four times a year with this committee of eminent linguists, and we could never carry on a conversation at lunch, because as soon as somebody said, "I like this salad," somebody else would say, "That word salad comes from the old church Slavic, which in Western Armenian has a totally different meaning," and that would be the end of the conversation. And there were at that time 10 linguistics departments in the United States that were looking for chairmen. I think it was very, very difficult to keep a linguistics department organized and unified. But that's an entirely outsider's slant on that subject. Now, I should perhaps say a little bit about water resources management here, if you're ready for that.
That also is, where did I see that? It's covered in a Newsweek publication in some of their papers, the development of the course.
Yes, maybe so.
But the point is, why you feel it was significant and at the time, and
okay,
what made you think of it. And
okay, well, the university's formal master's degree program in water resources management enrolled its first student in 1965. And one of the people in that first batch is now the chairman of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, that's Stephen Bourne. But before that year, 1965, there was almost 10 years of development. And I know about the early stage of that development, because in a year which I think was 1956, after my return from my first trip to India, I telephoned Professor Arno Lenz, who was the senior man in the civil engineering department dealing with the subfield of hydraulic engineering, and asked him if he would eat lunch. And we met at Trip Commons. I had never seen him before. And I asked him whether he would consider team teaching a course in river basin planning. That was obviously a subject that I was interested in from my work in the Tennessee Valley Authority, but also I was interested in it because of my doctor's thesis on the Missouri. And I felt that there was a body of comparative information that I could bring forward from an administrative and political point of view if we could relate it to his knowledge of the hydrology and the engineering possibilities for developing the water resources in river basins. And he simply said yes. He didn't demur, he didn't say, "Let's consider that, I want to talk to my colleagues." He just said yes. And my own feeling, aside from the fact that he was a very imaginative and generous man, he was then probably 50 years old. I think that his appreciation that there was such a field of knowledge came from the fact that he himself had worked as an engineering consultant in the TVA, and the TVA was both a very engineeringly pioneering venture, but also it was itself a kind of great university because people of different disciplines used to meet regularly, not only on their official time, but even in the evening also, to study ideas about combining different skills in developing the resources of water and related to water. So anyway, Lenz was enthusiastic about that, and that year or the next year we launched this seminar, and most of the students were in fact students of engineering, most of them master's students in engineering, a few foreign students, and Lenz would start off the semester by putting into terms I could understand the concepts of where the water came from and the topography of the basin and what were the economic uses of the water and how engineering projects could make those uses feasible and so forth. And then I would come with the how these things are decided by governments and how popular support is obtained or lost and what sort of administrative organization will make use of or fail to make use of the technical potential. And Lenz was convinced that nobody in the country was doing this sort of thing. In any event, Harvard very quickly started a well-funded and much larger and eventually much more influential program, which resulted in much of the development of the concept of benefit-cost analysis of river basin projects and the publication of several books. But Lenz was convinced that our seminar antedated the Harvard venture by a couple of years.
Did Harvard ever get in touch with you about it?
Yes, or? Yes. Oh. The political scientist was a very close friend of mine.
Well, do you think,
at Harvard.
Did you talk to him about it?
Yes. We used to meet in political science meetings and give papers on subjects related to this. But Lenz, being such an influential man, I think carried the confidence and certainly the support of the engineering college into that venture. Now, very soon we were joined by Martin Glaser, who was a utility economist, G-L-A-S-E-R, and he was interested in the concepts of pricing the products of river development, like electricity. And he was interested in accurately allocating the costs of multiple purpose developments, because unless you could be fair and objective about what part of a dam and reservoir was the cost of generating hydroelectric power, you couldn't be fair about what price to put on your electricity. And he also had gotten into that through his consultancy for TVA. So I think the fact that TVA was innovative and truly interdisciplinary, and the fact that we had all worked there, was a very strong reason why we found it possible to pool our efforts and to excite one another with our respective contributions. But there too is a case where political science very readily said, okay, you can offer this for political science credit. Only a couple people a year would come from the political science department to study in that seminar, because it was way off at the fringes of any normal political science interest. But nevertheless, the department gave me a green light on it. Soon after that, I went back to India, and while I was gone, a colleague of mine in political science named Fred Clarenbach filled in that seminar, and he got some federal commission to do some work with regard to the organization of one of the American River projects. It was actually in the Arkansas Valley. And he was interested in putting that experience into the seminar. And my chairman then, who was at that stage Bill Young, said to me that Clarenbach wants to do this, and you have now started doing things such as your Civilization of India course with regard to India, so why don't you make room for Clarenbach? And I did that, although I wasn't entirely happy with that arrangement because I was still interested in river basins. But nevertheless, very quickly, I stopped doing research on river basins and began doing research on other matters with regard to India. And I'm sure one reason for that shift of my interest was that all of us who were concerned with the politics of river basins could see that the federal government was very poorly organized for that subject, and yet that nothing could be done about that because there had been a series of the most damaging criticisms of the way the federal government was organized. But because the log rolling process in Congress made the present organization unassailable politically, it was useless to come forward with any proposals for change. So the fact that in 1957 I wrote the last piece that I published on river basin, on the political science of river basins, and I think it was for that reason. That's why I started doing my publishing, my organized research and so forth on India. But in the meantime, a very strong individual joined this river basin seminar, and that was Jake Boischer, a man who was thoroughly attuned to the needs and possibilities of the state of Wisconsin. And he began to bring law students into it, and it it gathered a great deal of practical value for the state. Then in 65, grants became available for water research to each of the states, and Jerry Rolick became the head of the Water Resources Center, which did research with that money, and the state gave some appropriations for water research, and there came very soon federal traineeships also for graduate students taking graduate work in water resources management, so that in 65 the degree program took off with great strength, with fully funded stipends for the graduate students, and with counterpart funds to pay for the office secretary and so forth.
So this was all from your lunch and trip?
Well, a lot of other things, a lot of other things, but Lenz was very generous a couple times in identifying that as the source of the ideas. But there's one thing that is necessary to recognize. That program, Water Resources Management, was going strong for several years before it made its connection with Institute of Environmental Studies, because IES only started in 69. So this program was 4 years old before IES existed. And there was some very arduous negotiation between the Water Resources Management Faculty Executive Committee and the director of IES before the decision was reached, and with some reservations on both sides to bring this program into the Institute of Environmental Studies.
This was Reed Bryson and
Reed Bryson.
And who was the director of the Water Resources Management at that
time? It might have been Rolick. It might have been The fellow who was director when I came back into the program was Dave Stevenson, geologist. But I came back in a good deal later, not much later, because Water Resources Management didn't join IES immediately on IES creation, but only a few years later. So I would estimate